This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Last week we had the fascinating concept of the Ribbono Shel Olam creating a situation where a tzaddik at the end of his life comes up to Shemayim and meets with the Ribbono Shel Olam in a relationship where the Ribbono Shel Olam is indebted to the tzaddik. And that is even though the Ribbono Shel Olam says, and we learned the Medrash at the end of Iyov last week, Mihik Demoni V'Ashalim, who has preceded me with anything that I need to pay him? Mikiles Lefonayad Shelein Osati Lein Neshomo, has anybody ever praised me before I've given him a soul? Mi mal divnoyad shelein usati loibein, has anybody performed a bris milah on his son unless I had given him a son first? Mi also tzitzis ad shelein usati loitalis, has anybody put tzitzis on a garment if I have not given him the garment first? So mitzvahs, we said, are all in response to acts of chesed by the Ribbono Shel Olam. There are no mitzvahs that we do where we initiate the mitzvah. Every mitzvah we do is already a response. So by doing the mitzvah, we at best reinstate a state of equilibrium. The Ribbono Shel Olam does something for us and we respond with the mitzvah. The mitzvah is not an initiation. We might say, but a mitzvah is spiritual. And these examples are material. It's true God gave us life. It's true that God might have given us a son or an item of clothing, or a house on which to build a makeh, or place onto which to build a sukkah. But what Hashem gave us is physical, is material. And what we respond with is spiritual. We respond in a much greater way, in a sense, than that which we've received. So that's true. For that we have Olam Habos. The Ribbono Shel Olam now responds back to us and balances it all by the portion in Olam Habo, which we create for ourselves out of the mitzvahs that we do. So everything is perfectly equal. And the whole concept of nothing for nothing is in fact a Torah concept. The Ribbono Shel Olam made this world in order that we should receive nothing for nothing. There is a humiliation, there is an embarrassment in achieving something for nothing. So the Ribbono Shel Olam, who wanted to provide us with the limitless good that he has available for us, everything that he has for us is Olam Habo, but he doesn't want to give it out to us in a way that would embarrass us or humiliate us or in any way belittle us. So he built this entire universe, he built this world as a means of enabling us to be masters of our own goodness, as the Derech Hashem puts it. To be the Baalei HaTov, that we should be the owners of our own goodness. There is tremendous esteem in ownership. And anything that we don't own, that we have but don't own, lacks something about it which it doesn't build our self-esteem. Ownership is very important. Bailus, to own something, is very important. And ownership is something which expresses itself in many different areas. It's true that where ownership is emphasized, one opens the gate to the emotions and the feelings of lust and of jealousies and of ambition and all sorts of things. Good. So these things have to be controlled and directed. The answer to that is not to deprive people of ownership. The line which the kibbutzim took at the beginning when the state was founded and before that, of depriving members of ownership, the whole socialist idea, is not something which can possibly build great human beings in terms of self-esteem. A person's self-esteem comes from what he has mastered, comes from what he owns, from what he's been able to dominate, from what he's been able to conquer, not what he's been handed out. And so it is in all the areas. In Limudat Torah too, the whole idea of being mechadish, of learning something with individuality, with a degree of uniqueness, of looking at a passage and finding something new in it that others have not found, that gives one a sense of mastery, a sense of ownership. That, in that way, one is koine. We talk about being koine Torah, the kinyonim, the 48 kinyonim, the acquisitions, the methods of acquisitions of Torah. It's not good enough to be exposed to something, to learn something. There needs to be ownership. And ownership is difficult. Ownership requires investment. Ownership requires work. Ownership requires toil. Ownership requires conquest. But if ownership doesn't develop, then the relationship doesn't develop and the self-esteem doesn't develop. And we live in a time and we live in a society where the importance of ownership is being undermined and is being seen as negative, in fact. The importance of mastering something to the point where it becomes yours. And I suppose this is still the effects of communism. And perhaps it's wrong, just as an aside, for us to view the events of the last 6 or 9 months as the demise of communism. Perhaps all that's happened is communism has no role anymore, because it's managed to implant itself so firmly in the entire Western world. There isn't so much of a conflict anymore between communism and capitalism, because the whole world has become communist, in a sense. This concept of finding virtue in not owning, of minimizing the values of ownership, and the ability of people to get by without contributing, is really all part of what it's all about. The vast amounts of money that the third world owes the Western world, and the fact that this is accepted and virtually written off, that's communism. The enormous social benefits, the enormous unemployment, and the fact that people can earn as much being unemployed as they can employed, that's all communism, that's all socialism. Enormous governments that employ hundreds of thousands, millions of people, enormous tax burdens, this is all part of communism in a slightly different form. It's not as if communism has now disappeared. The damage that has been done to the human psyche by undermining the value of ownership is something which we're still suffering from, and we're going to suffer for a long time. And that value is undermined not only in the non-Jewish world, but also the Jewish world, and also in the Torah world. The need to feel ownership. I'm taking these principles and I'm talking a little bit ad lib here in extending them, because they're so fundamental. In Torah, let's take a few examples of where one sees the value of ownership being undermined. The concept of the shtibl. What is a shtibl as opposed to a community? A community is a shul, big shuls around the town. Those are congregations. Communities, they're not shtibulach. What does it mean it's a community, it's a congregation? It has a building, it has property, it employs a rov and secretaries, a chazan, choir, the community. It has a cheder, a nursery school. Why does that make it a community? Because that needs vast investments. That cannot be produced by people who pop in and out. You cannot build something by a transient population. A community is built by members, contributing members. So how did these shuls start? When these Jews came from Lithuania and they established themselves in South Africa, what did they do? In every town they formed a community. And the community required contributors, it required investors, people who saw that as their future, people who struggled and battled, people who could hardly pay their accounts, who couldn't pay their accounts. But to pay for a cheder teacher, to pay for a reverend, to have a sefer Torah, to have a cheder, to have a shul, to have a mikveh in many of the little towns, that there was no question about. And these small little communities of impoverished people used to build and build and develop. That's a community. Doesn't matter how small it is or how big it is, that's a community. A shtibl is a different sort of a place. A shtibl is a place which hardly has a building, and if it has a building, it's in bad repair. It doesn't have a rov, doesn't have a chazan, it doesn't have a choir. Fine, that might be some of the advantages of the shtibl, but the reason it doesn't have these things is not only in principle, but the reason of it is it's there to serve a transient population. It's not there as a it's not a place of contributors. It's a service place, it's a place to provide. And that concept that there has to be ownership through investment in community life, for example, is something which the frum world doesn't understand. The non-religious world understands it. The traditional Jew understands that. And the traditional Jew, in a particular, in a place like South Africa, not all over. In the United States, it's a little different. But in a place like South Africa, the traditional Jew understands that. And he builds schools, and he has organizations that raise the money, and old-aged homes are built, and hospitals are built, and all the necessary things are built by people who understand that they have to make a contribution. And there are gaboi tzedokah who go around to the community and they demand contributions, like a tax collector. There's an IUA and there's a UCF, and there are all sorts of community structures which have to be supported by people who are living in the country. That's a community. But where you've got a kind of a shtibel organization, where you've got people come and they go, and when they feel like it, they give a bit of an adobe, if they get an aliyah, if they don't feel like it, they don't. And casual. That's all very fine and very nice. But there isn't a sense of ownership. Of I want to invest in a place. I want to build the place because it's mine. Because I want to feel ownership. I want to feel that I've made a contribution. It's not just in a financial sense. That's a person who understands that he's got to be at the minyan early. Because I want to make that contribution. I would like to ensure that if there are other people there, that somebody has to say a Kaddish. I want to make that contribution to make sure that I'm there. I want to invest in it because it's mine. That's why I want to do it. When there's a shir, I want to be there. When there's chavrusas, I want to be there. Not just for what I can learn from it, but for what I can give to it, for what I can invest in it, for what I can build through my being there. The understanding that in order to be an owner in Torah, I've got to make that contribution. In order to feel that I have a share in what's going on, I've got to invest in what's going on. That kind of feeling the frum world hasn't got. And so they drift from shtibel to shtibel and from community to community, spend a few years in this one and a few years in that one. One Shabbos they daven here and one Shabbos they daven there, without any feeling of this is mine. And this transience, this tourism, means that relationship that one would develop never does develop. And you see a founder member of one of the big shuls in Johannesburg, when he comes to shul, he walks into the shul and he looks around at the structure and he looks around at the people sitting in the shul, and he sees Kenan Hora, a full shul, and he sees hundreds of little children running around, and he breaks down out into this warm smile. And he thinks back to the years when he had to struggle to be able to pay. And then there was a building levy when they put up the building. And then there was a second building levy when they put up the cheder. And then they had to employ a second rov because the shul was, each time it took, it was mesiris nefesh, and how he had to do it, but he was part of that. And he looks around him and he feels satisfied. He feels satisfied with that unique satisfaction that comes from a balabos, from somebody who feels, I'm looking at the fruits of investment. I'm not eating something that somebody else invested in. This is mine. I had a part in building this. And my concern is that the frum community here and elsewhere doesn't have that feeling, doesn't have that understanding, doesn't have that pleasure of in years to come to be able to look and say, this is a place I built up with sweat and tears. I used to be there in the mornings to make sure there was a minyan. I used to give money to it to make sure that it could survive. I used to have Talmidim there that I could teach. I had Chavrusas there that there was learning going on. I built it. I put into that. That's something that one doesn't have, because the concept of ownership is not something which is understood as a spiritual concept. The concept of ownership is being marketed not only as a secular concept, but as a negative secular concept. As an expression of greed, as an expression of ambition, of all the negative things that they have to be. It's not so at all. As we learned last Motzei Shabbos, domination is not negative. The word domination perhaps is an unfortunate word, or it's come to be used unfortunately. When we talk about domination, we're talking about impacting on one's environment. And one can only impact in one's environment if one is a balabos. One can only impact on one's environment if one has a share in that environment. A tourist has no impact on the environment. A tourist comes and a tourist goes. And he leaves the environment unaffected. He takes from the environment, yes. And he sometimes does what he does contribute to the environment sometimes, is he leaves his litter behind. And the residents have to clean it up. That's about as far as a tourist contributes to his environment. And that's what we've got to be careful, that we don't go through life as tourists. That we go through life as investors. That we go through life as citizens. That we build our businesses, that we build our professions, that we build our homes, that we build our communities, and that at all times we feel we're investing in something that we want a share of. And then there can be some kind of building of self-esteem. Then one gets feedback from one's environment. A tourist doesn't get feedback from the environment. A balabos, a citizen, a resident, gets feedback from the environment. And particularly in South Africa, one has to be careful at this stage, because the country is going through an uncertain stage, and people willy-nilly, whether they like to admit it or not, are adopting an attitude of, at best, let's wait and see, and if things really go to the dogs, I'll clear out. Which is fine, okay, one understands in a situation such as this, and in uncertain times such as this, one understands such an attitude. But the danger is that it breeds in one a tendency to regard oneself not as a contributor. because one doesn't look at a long-term future. And we've spoken so often about the fact that even if one is in a place short-term, one has to live there with a long-term future. One has to contribute and one has to invest. Back to the old story of the old man, you'll remember planting the carob trees, being asked, what are you doing it for? One has to live in a place investing. You can't live in a place touring, even if one's there very briefly. And I was with a businessman on Friday who was encountering the most enormous corruption in one of his organizations. He just discovered bribery and the most theft, most terrible corruption. And I said, how long is it going on for? He said, he doesn't know, but it's fairly recent. And I said, what started it? And he said, I'll tell you my theory. Everybody knows we're going to close that operation down. It's been running at a loss. Since the time people realize that we're going to close it down, each person is just trying to get whatever he can from it before it closes down. And that's what one has to be aware of in a climate such as exists in this country at the moment. If we don't become part of this attitude of chap what you can and clear out, even if one isn't going to clear out, because that destroys the very essence of human dignity. And it's all very well trying to get out of the army and trying to get out of taxes and trying to get out of... Our whole existence is becoming trying to get out of obligations, trying to get out of responsibilities. And that can create a very weird sort of human being. And we have to watch that and we have to be careful of that. In our national relationships, in our international relationships, in our communal relationships, in our family relationships, in our professional relationships, to understand at all times that each day of our lives we have to be investing. Each day of our lives we have to lay down roots and strengthen the environment from which we feed. Otherwise there cannot be that kind of give and take. We discussed last week how the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us this opportunity to earn our goodness, to invest in our own Olam Habo. That's really what it is. Instead of giving us an Olam Habo on a plate, instead of giving us a world to come on the plate, the Ribbono Shel Olam has created for us a mechanism that enables us to invest and construct our own Olam Haba. That when we come to Olam Haba, we won't be looking at gifts, we won't be looking at things that aren't related to ourselves. We will simply be seeing the spiritual consequences of our physical actions. That's all. This is when a businessman looks at an empire he's built up, he doesn't say to himself, my goodness, isn't that wonderful of God? I worked all these years and look what he gave me. Not that at all. He says, this is what I worked, this is what I built, this is my labor. So it is when the Ribbonish, when we've come up to Olam Habo, what we see there is not a reward for what we did. What we see there is what we did. That is the result of what we did. That is the fruit, the spiritual profits, the spiritual benefits that have been generated through the years of our toil in this physical world. And so there's a state of equilibrium that we're able to reach if we live our lives correctly. However, we discussed last week that the Ribbono Shel Olam built a further mechanism in whereby he enabled us to dominate him to the point where he becomes indebted to us. That's the ultimate of the human being. Not only is he able to dominate his environment, which is already a pretty big thing because the environment is a powerful place, but the Ribbono Shel Olam enabled us not only to dominate our environment and to dominate ourselves, but even in a sense, kibyochel, so to say, to dominate him. Because if a Tzadik Gomer who's done all he's supposed to do comes to Olam HaEmes, and in addition to having done all the mitzvahs, he's lived a life of suffering, then he comes to the Ribbono Shel Olam and the Ribbono Shel Olam still owes him something. And to be able to confront our Maker in a situation where he owes us something is a very unique relationship which the Tzadik Gomer is able to develop. And that, we said, was the meaning of the suffering of Yisurim Shel Ahavo that the human being is able to achieve. That being the principle that nothing is for nothing and we don't want anything for nothing, we have a certain difficulty with this week's Sedra. The Medrash on Vayeschanan brings a pasuk from Mishle, Tachanunim yedaber rosh v'osher yane azus. A poor person speaks with supplications and a wealthy person answers with strength, with power. The Medrash gives various interpretations of that posuk, and I'm going to deal with one this evening. That's Rabbi Yochanan. Omer Rabbi Yochanan, Tachanunim yedaber rash. What is an example of poor people speaking in supplications? Elu Nevi'a Yisrael. This is the prophets of Israel. V'oshir Yane Azus Elu Nevi'a Umasoilum. And a wealthy person answering with strength, with power, that's the prophets of the nations of the world. Omar Rabbi Yochanan Ein Lechol Tzadik B'Umasoilum Yosem Iyuf. The greatest tzaddik among the non-Jewish people was Iyuf. And when he communicated with the Ribbono Shel Olam, he communicated with rebuke. He said, "Say, rebuked God." Shneimar, as it says, "Ercho lefon of mishpot ufi amolei teichoches." I shall lay before him justice, and my mouth is full of rebuke. And the greatest of the prophets are Moshe, of the Jewish prophets are Moshe and Yeshaya. Veshneihem loybo elo betachanunim. And both of them communicate with the Ribbono Shel Olam only with tachanun, with supplication. What does that mean? Iyuv, a non-Jewish prophet, claims from God on the basis of fairness and justice. And the impact of his entire argument to the Ribbono Shel Olam is, Ribbono Shel Olam, what you're doing to me is not fair. I'm a tzaddik, I've done nothing wrong, I've lived my life uprightly, you owe me something, this is not fair. This suffering, this pain, this terrible sorrow which you're imposing upon me, all that is not fair. And that, says the Medrash, is an example of Oshir Yane Azus, a wealthy person answering with power. In other words, Iyuv has a great deal of tzchuyus, he has a great deal of merit, he's a tzaddik, and he's calling in his credit. That is the Azus with which a wealthy person can speak. He's calling in his credit, he's using his power. What is my power, says Iyuv? You owe me something, Ribbono Shel Olam. I've lived an upright life. How can you do this to me? But the Nevi Yisrael speak as poor people. What does it mean? They don't have credit. Of course they do have credit. But Rashi says in the opening of this week's Sedra, Ein chanun b'chol mokoim, Eloloshin matnos chinom. What does this word supplication mean? Chino. The root is chesnun from chen. And the word chen, says Rashi, comes from chino. Chino means nothing. And so tachanunim, when a person uses the phrase tachanunim to supplication, that means a request for an undeserved gift. That's what tachanun. I'm asking the Ribbono Shel Olam to do something for me which I'm not claiming a right to. I'm asking for him to do it just so, and it over and above any rights. And Rashi adds, Afal pi sheyesh lahem latzadikim litlis b'maaseihim hatoivim. Asks Rashi, but tzadikim are able to ask on the basis of their rights. Tzadikim have done so much good, they can demand using their rights. Moshe Rabbeinu could demand on the basis of his ma'aseh, look what I've done, Ribbono Shel Olam, surely you owe me to go into Eretz Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu could have used that argument. I've served you, I've done everything you want, I've never done anything wrong, one little aveiro, but such a punishment I've done, tshuva for that aveiro. Is that all? And all this time that I've served you and I've led the nation and I've brought them to this point, and you won't let me go into Eretz Yisrael? Moshe Rabbeinu and all the tzaddikim, yeshlem litlis b'maaseim, they could, just as Iyuv did, they could demand justice and fairness. And indeed it would have been just and fair for the Ribbono Shel Olam to let Moshe go into Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't just in a sense. If we're going to look at Moshe's actions, at Moshe's dedication to the Ribbono Shel Olam, it wasn't fair what God did to keep him out of Eretz Yisrael. That wasn't nice. And Moshe could have used that argument, it's not fair. I have a right, I have an entitlement to go into Eretz Yisrael. Nevertheless, Ein mevakshim me'esamokim elo matnos chinam. They don't ask from Hashem anything other than a matnos chinam. They want a gift for nothing. They're not prepared to pay with their ma'asim tovim. Now that appears to go right against everything we've said. Why should a tzaddik want a matnos chinam? The whole purpose of this creation is that we should get nothing for nothing. God created this world so that we can invest in every item of goodness He gives us, so that we don't find that we're being dished out good things without having worked for them, without having toiled for them, without having invested in them. That's the purpose of Olam Hazeh, is the investment opportunities. And the whole Bria has been created for that purpose, so that we should come to the Ribbono Shel Olam feeling that everything He's given to us, we have deserved, we have worked for, so that there isn't an indebtedness. And here Rashi tells us that the Tzaddikim, this Yisrael, that the Tzaddikim have all, although they're able to use a claim of actions to say we deserve this, we've worked for it, they don't. They ask for a handout, matnas chinum. They ask for a handout. But let's analyze a little bit more carefully what this matnas chinum is. We have three words that we're looking at. We've got the words of tachanunim, supplication. We've got chinom, which means nothing, for nothing. And we've got chen, which is one of those untranslatable words. Grace, chen, chen means chen. And they're all connected. A real matnas chinom, a gift for nothing in the literal sense, if such a thing exists, is where a person initiates a gift and the initiation is totally his. He does it there's nothing in the recipient of the gift that plays any part in the initiation of the action. But that's not matnas chinom. If we're going to see the relationship between chen and chinom, then that's not chinom yet. That's not what chinom means. We often find the phrase in the Torah, Im motzosi chen beinecho, if I have found favor in your eyes, do A, B, C, do such and such and do such and such. What does it mean, if I have found chen in your eyes? If it's a matnas chinom, if it means just for nothing, then one should say, even if I haven't found favor in your eyes, please do it. Just chinom, for nothing, for no reason at all. Im motzosi chen beinecho, if I have found favor in your eyes, means that there is something in me which should make you want to do this. So I'm really initiating. Now there are two kinds of ways that one can initiate an action in another person. One can arouse a response from another person. The one is using power and domination. That's the one way, as we discussed last week, that I can call in credit, that I have I have authority over you. I'm able to influence you. I have some form of power over you. That's one way I can get you to do something. Whether that power is overt or covert. It might be the power of manipulation. It might be the power of persuasion. Whatever it is, but I can influence you. I have an influence over you which I can use. That's one way that I can initiate an action. I can initiate a response in you. But there's another way. And that is to arouse sympathy in you. That's not through any direct power, but to make you feel sorry for me. And a human being is such that when he feels sympathy, he likes to do something about it, he likes to express it. And that perhaps is the difference between a salesman and a charity collector. A salesman doesn't do well if he arouses sympathy. That's not what you're not supposed to buy from a salesman because you feel sorry for him. He's got to try and make you want to do it in your own interests, not in his interests. But if a person's collecting charity, that's a little bit more difficult, although some of the very good charity collectors who are salesmen as well do make you feel that. But on the simplest level, what does he do? How does the charity collector collect his charity? If he's just going to sit there, imagine you find these people sitting, beggars sitting on the street. Imagine they sat in an immaculate clothing with gold wristwatches and cufflinks and their tie perfectly in position, perfectly groomed, and they sit at a nice desk on the pavement with a big executive chair and a tin in front of them. Who's going to put anything inside the tin? Why not? And if he says to you, excuse me sir, I need some charity, what are you going to do then? He also won't put anything in the tin. He doesn't arouse your sympathy. He doesn't have the power of persuasion. He's got nothing to offer you. He's not a salesman, nor does he arouse your sympathy. But if he appears in torn clothes and he looks a bit emaciated, And he puts on a terribly pathetic face, and if he can have a child sitting there as well, who's preferably without an arm and a leg, whatever can be done, all these assist in the arousal of sympathy, and they create a response. You've got to respond. You can't just walk past that and not respond. What kind of human being can do that? So the two kinds of responses are either where I'm in a position of dominance, whatever the type of dominance, whatever form it takes. If I'm in a position of dominance, I can affect my environment, or I can also affect my environment from a position of sympathy. To arouse sympathy in the other person, I can do so too. Now, of course, that opens the way to manipulation as well. You find people who know how to make you sympathize in order to arouse a response, but it's all manipulated. Good. One has to be alert for that kind of thing too. And that's what chen is. Chen is the arousal of sympathy or empathy in the other person. And that doesn't have to be because the other person is a nebuch in a negative sense. That can be just because the other person is in some form of need. And we discussed in the late issue this morning, in fact, that that is the dynamics between the man-woman relationship. That's the husband-wife dynamic, in a sense. That the ego, the male ego, is sustained by the fact that a capable, worthwhile woman needs him. And we discussed if the woman is totally incapable and totally without personality at all, that doesn't boost his ego at all, the fact that she needs him. If one is needed by somebody who is totally useless, that doesn't make one feel particularly good. The greater the person is who needs one, the greater is the ego boost that comes as a result of acknowledging that need and responding to that need. And so a woman has to walk that very fine line between, on one hand, making herself a personality that is a source of pride to him, and yet making him feel that she needs him. And when you've got that combination of emotion, the man responds, automatically will respond, if he'd have to respond. And that's one of the fundamental responses to tzedakah. Why people give tzedakah very often, not people who give tzedakah 100% l'shem shamayim, they do it because it's a mitzvah. What is it that gets people who don't do any other mitzvahs, but tzedakah they're willing to give, and in big amounts sometimes? It's not just the COVID. It's not that they get their name up in lights. It's the feeling of being needed. And that's why I'm told by the collectors that if you underplay your hand, you can miss it altogether. If you go to a big potential and you ask for too small an amount, he might give nothing. There are people who respond to a big feeling of need. If you go to somebody and you say, you know, we really need you. We need $1 million. That's what we need. It's a major project. It's a massive thing. And yeah, there are lots of people giving, but we need your $1 million. That makes him feel important. $1 million you need from me. Do you need me that much? So much you need me. That actually arouses a response in him. You come and say, you know, we need you, $100 please, would help us a great deal. It doesn't do anything for you. I'll give you the $100, maybe. It doesn't do anything for his ego. They come to me for $100. That's not because of me. They could go to anybody. I'm just on the list, that's all. They're doing the rounds. They're knocking on everybody's door. They came to me as well. If one comes and one asks for $1 million, that creates a sense of need. And the bigger the sense of need from a worthwhile source, the greater is the sustenance that is given to the ego. And that's the power of chen. And that's the immotsosi chen beinecha. If I have aroused in you a sense of chen, a chen is a sense where you are responding to a need in me because you sympathize and empathize with me, not because you owe me anything, not because I have any power over you. And if you look at all the cases of immotsosi chen beinecha, it's always said by somebody who is in an inferior position from the point of view of that negotiation to somebody who's in a superior position, somebody who hasn't got a claim. Immotsosi chen beinecha, if I found favor in your eyes, let me please do it as a sympathy. I need you. And people like to be needed, provided that need is genuine, and provided there is the chen, provided there is that dynamics that makes the person want to respond to that need. That's chen. Chinom. Matnos chinom does not mean something for nothing. Matnos chinom means something which is given in response to sympathy, not in response to demand. In response to sympathy, not in response to authority. So if a balabos comes, if an employer comes to an employee on his hands and knees and he says, please feel sorry for me, I need you to do such and such, that doesn't arouse, that's not the right relationship. He has the right to demand, you're working for me, this is what I need you to do. But if somebody who doesn't have that kind of claim comes to a person, if you walk up to somebody in the street, you need a letter typed, you walk up to the first lady you see in the street, you say, please, sir, just come in and take dictation. Who do you think you are? But if you walk up to her and you say, you know, I'm in a terrible position. I don't know you from a bar of soap. I can see you're a secretary. My secretary has just walked out. This is a terribly urgent letter. I don't know what to do. And you look all miserable and sad and droopy-eyed and tears start coming out. There's a chance that she'll say, okay, come, I'll help you. It will take 10 minutes. What do you have to do? What has worked? What has one done? One can't use domination in a situation like that. One has used chen. One's appealed to a sense of sympathy. I'm in trouble and I need you. And people like to be needed. That's what chen is, the response to need. So with that understanding, let's try and relearn the Rashi. This tefillah of tachanun, of supplication in every place, is eloloshon matnos chinam. This is a gift for nothing, but not now a gift for nothing. This is a response to sympathy that the person claims. When a person claims, whether using the word tachanun, what he's claiming is, please, Ribbono Shel Olam, sympathize with me and respond to me in terms of that sympathy with us. I'm not demanding it because I have a hold over you. I'm asking you to sympathize with me and to give it to me in sympathy. Even though they could demand it, even though they have enough zechuyos, even though the tzaddikim have the power to say, Ribbono Shel Olam, I demand it as justice, you owe this to me. They choose not to do so. And let's examine, using the principles that we've developed over the last couple of weeks, to understand why not. Take Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu finds himself at the stage, at the end of his life, having lived a life of absolute tzidkus. From the beginning, right through at every step, this is a tzaddik gomer. Moshe Rabbeinu, the highest level that the human being is able to reach. And the everything he's done, as we learned last week, is really in response to opportunities that the Ribbono Shel Olam has given to him. So from the point of view of his tzidkus, a tzaddik gomer, an absolute tzaddik, comes to the Ribbono Shel Olam at the end of his life in a state of equilibrium. You don't owe me anything, I don't owe you anything. You gave me opportunities, I used those opportunities to serve you. I invested in my own Olam Habo. So the Olam Habo, the eternal life you're about to grant me, is something I developed for myself, it's something I built and constructed for myself. But Moshe Rabbeinu has suffered a great deal. Moshe Rabbeinu, from his earliest childhood, separated from his parents, put in the little basket on the river, brought up in the house of Paro, having to flee, going off to Midian, marrying in Midian, living in the house of Yisro, as a shepherd, a man of the caliber of Moshe Rabbeinu. He could have been a chief rabbi even in a country like this, he could have made it. But look what he has to live his life. A shepherd in Midian. Not a Rosh Yeshiva, not a Rov, not a businessman, a shepherd working for Yisro. Until the age of 80, when he's finally ready to, and who knows what, imagine 80 is the time when most people's careers are over. So at 80, had Moshe gone into retirement, what sense of achievement would he have had? I've been a good shepherd for 80 years. Fine, okay. 80, his career starts. At 80, he's pulled into the service of the Ribbono Shel Olam to take Bnei Israel out of Egypt and to take them through those harrowing 40 years, during which time he's humiliated by them, he's pestered by them, he's overwhelmed by them, he's troubled by them. Right through, just go through each stage of that 40 years. How there wasn't really any moment of relaxation and of pleasure. On and on it goes. And finally, after 40 years, he's now ready for true retirement. And all he wants before for his retirement is to go into Eretz Yisrael. What about that suffering? That suffering is what gives him the chen. That suffering is what enables him to say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, you owe me something not for what I've done, but just sympathize with me. Look what life I've had. Just give me a few days of pleasure. Let me get into Eretz Yisrael. Just sympathize with me. I want sympathy. I don't want payment. I don't want justice. I just want sympathy. That's what he wants. And if that would be so, if the Ribbono Shel Olam would say, yeah, okay, I sympathize with you. Poor Moshe. You haven't had a life. Let's at least give you a life now. Your job is over. Your responsibilities are over. You go into Eretz Yisrael. You'll have a short time, but at least you'll see the fruits of your labors and you'll be able to enjoy it before you die. You're right. It's not payment. You're going in because I sympathize. Having sympathized with Moshe in that way, when Moshe confronts the Ribbono Shel Olam ultimately after his death, what would the relationship then be between them? Now it's back to equilibrium. In other words, we discussed last week that through the suffering, through undeserved suffering, when we come to the Ribbono Shel Olam, he sympathizes with us. Although everything we've got there we've earned, in addition to that we've suffered. And that suffering has been undeserved, that suffering has been innocent. So when we come, the Ribbono Shel Olam views us with a sense of sympathy, there's chen. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, I owe you something, you've gone through a hard time. It's not just a business deal of quid pro quo. That's fine, you've invested and here's the fruit of your investment, but in addition to that you've suffered. And that suffering arouses in the Ribbono Shel Olam a sense of sympathy towards us. And that's why he gives us the Yisurin Shel Ahava. That's why a tzaddik suffers, so that he can come to the Ribbono Shel Olam and there is that emotional relationship of sympathy towards him when he gets there. But if the Ribbono Shel Olam has already paid out that sympathy, then when he comes to the Ribbono Shel Olam, there's no sympathy left. Now he comes to the Ribbono Shel Olam, everything he gets in Olam Habo, he's worked for. Fine. That's a state of equilibrium. All the mitzvahs he did were in response to the opportunities Hashem gave him. State of equilibrium. The only thing that puts the Ribbono Shel Olam in a situation of, so to say, indebtedness, the only thing that arouses in the Ribbono Shel Olam a sense of sympathy towards Moshe, is that you suffered undeservedly. But if he would let him into Eretz Yisrael, then that feeling would also cease to exist. Moshe Rabbeinu would not, the Ribbono Shel Olam would not have to feel that sense of sympathy. It's true you suffered, Moshe, but I paid you off for that suffering too. You went into Eretz Yisrael, and I didn't take it off your points at all. I didn't take it off your mitzvahs. And I did that because I sympathize with you. Now when you come to Olam HaEmes, I don't even have to sympathize with you. And that's what Moshe is asking for. Moshe says, pay me for my suffering by letting me into Eretz Yisrael. Now there is a chazal that had Moshe Rabbeinu gone into Eretz Yisrael, there would never have been a golus. The power of possession of Eretz Yisrael would have been so enormous that there would never have been an exile. The destructions of the temples would not have been able to take place. Which is, so to say, one of the reasons that the Ribbono Shel Olam chose to keep Moshe out. What does it mean? Why would that have been so? Had the Ribbono Shel Olam responded to Moshe's suffering by letting him into Eretz Yisrael, that response wouldn't be enough just to let him in. If that would be responding to his suffering, he would have to let him in with such permanence and with such power that he would still owe it to his children and children's children and so on. You remember last week we mentioned that the power of the suffering of Avraham Avinu and the Ovis goes on until today. That's the Schus Ovis, that because they suffered, Hashem continues paying us. As Rashi said in chapter 41 of the Yud, Loi Acharish Bodov, Loi Acharish Albonov Shel Tzadik Sheholach Lefanai Besomim. I won't keep quiet to the children, to the descendants of the Tzadik who served me perfectly. Ulevonov Yishtal Muschar Toiv Avihem. And their children will be paid the good reward of their father, the Yimotsu Tovo Bischuso, and they will find goodness for his chus. So if the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to give Moshe entrance into Eretz Yisrael in response to his suffering, that entrance would have to be permanent entrance. That would have to be an entrance which could never be taken away from future generations. That would be the enormity of that schar. And Moshe wants it now. Moshe is willing to demand, pay me for my suffering by letting me into Eretz Yisrael, because I know, says Moshe, that if you let me into Eretz Yisrael for my suffering, you will never be able to take it away again. And I'm prepared to sacrifice the sympathy in Olam Habo for the assurance that we'll be in Eretz Yisrael forever. And to that the Ribbono Shel Olam says, no. I also know that if I let you into Eretz Yisrael, I'm going to have to keep the people there forever, that there will never be a golus, that I can never destroy the Beis HaMikdash. That's too powerful. It's true I owe you sympathy, Moshe, but keep that until you come up here. That's when I'll give you that sympathy. I'm not prepared to give it to you in the form of entrance into Eretz Yisrael. And so this is a bargaining between Moshe and the Ribbono Shel Olam. Moshe knowing that he's got his last card to play, and that is to call on Hashem's sympathy, and through that to allow him into Eretz Yisrael. And Hashem refusing it because he knows the power of that last card to play. He knows the power of the entrance into Eretz Yisrael if granted under those circumstances. There might be a second level of understanding too, and that is that Moshe Rabbeinu reached such a level where he didn't want to be in a position when he came to Olam HaEmes of the Ribbono Shel Olam having to feel sympathy towards him. That's still a higher level. If we go through the levels, you remember as we discussed last week, at first a person tries to get as much as he can and pay as little as he can. That's the first feeling of victory. I got a bargain. What did I got a bargain mean? I paid less for it than it was worth. Which really means I remain indebted. It means I stole, in a sense, doesn't it? It means that I got something worth more than I paid for it. Then one gets over that stage. One gets to a stage where one doesn't want anything that one's underpaid for. One doesn't want anything that one hasn't invested in. One doesn't want anything where one's going to be left with a sense of indebtedness. One wants to feel that whatever is mine, I've paid for. That's the next level. And that's the relationship between ourselves and the Ribbono Shel Olam. Then comes a level later where we say that we're prepared to accept Yisurim Shel Ahava, the Tzadik Gomor, suffers terribly. And he says, but I appreciate the meaning of the suffering, because the suffering is creating an indebtedness in God towards me. If it weren't for the suffering, we would be equal one to one another. I don't want to owe God anything. But through my suffering, God is going to owe me something. That's fine. Let the Ribono Shel Olam be the debtor. I'll be the creditor. That's even better. So the first level is where a person is happy to be a debtor. Then he goes into the next level. This is all a maturing process. Then he goes into the next level where he's not happy being a debtor. He wants to pay for everything. Then he goes into the third level where he wants to dominate others by making them the debtors. He wants to be the creditor. And so it is with the Ribono Shel Olam. Comes the point where we want to be God's creditor, and we're happy to feel that He owes us something, even if we have to suffer in this world to create that relationship. But there's one level higher than that. When Moshe says, I don't want to come there with you, the debtor. I don't want to be your creditor. I love you too much, Ribono Shel Olam, to see you having to sympathize with me, to see you having to owe me something. If you owe me something, pay me now. So that when I come to the Olam HaEmes, I don't owe you, and you don't owe me. I'm not your creditor, and you're not my creditor. We're equals. And if I suffered, I'm not calling in the actions that I've done. We go through that again, assuming that Moshe Rabbeinu would say, I'm willing to pay with my mitzvahs. I've done so many good deeds, Ribono Shel Olam. I demand that in return for some of those good deeds, you let me into Eretz Yisrael. That would be a fair claim. But then what would the relationship of debtor-creditor be? So there was equilibrium. There was equilibrium. So through the maisim, through the actions, there's equilibrium. Moshe suffers undeservedly, a life of suffering. That places God in the debtor situation. That Moshe Rabbeinu is the creditor now, he is entitled to something in return for his suffering. Now that Moshe Rabbeinu comes along and says, but some of those mitzvahs, let's use that to let me into Eretz Yisrael. And if Hashem would say, okay, go into Eretz Yisrael, we'll take off some of the mitzvahs, you'll pay for it. What relationship then remains between Moshe and the Ribono Shel Olam? The same relationship as before. God remains creditor and Moshe remains... God remains debtor and Moshe remains creditor. You still have to pay me for my suffering. Going into Eretz Yisrael was not for my suffering. I paid for that with mitzvahs. That Moshe doesn't want to do. My mitzvahs will be paid for in Olam HaEmes. That creates equilibrium. Now I still have one on you, Ribono Shel Olam. I have suffering that you owe me for. Pay me out now. Let me go into Eretz Yisrael, and then we'll be equal again. Then there'll be a situation of equality. That's the ultimate level of Ahavas Hashem, where one isn't satisfied that we are the creditors and the Ribono Shel Olam is the debtors, but where one wants to actually come to a situation of absolute equilibrium, the highest level achievable which Moshe Rabbeinu achieves. Those are the two ways of understanding why it was that that Moshe Rabbeinu wanted this Matnas Chinam, wanted to come into Eretz Yisrael, in return for the suffering which he had experienced. That gives us some kind of inkling as to the enormity of the schar of Olam Haba. As we said, Moshe's going into Eretz Yisrael would not just have been a transient one-off event. He would have gone in and had a look around. What Moshe was asking for was to go in and to see Yerushalayim and to build the Beis HaMikdash and to establish the foundations in such a way that it would never be destroyed. That is the degree of reward available for Moshe Rabbeinu, for the suffering that Moshe Rabbeinu went through. That would be his entitlement if he wanted to call it in. He didn't want to call it in. But one sees the enormity of it. That through the actions of a single human being, the whole of history can be changed as a result of that. Had Moshe gone into Eretz Israel, there would have been no Golus, there would have been no Churban Beis HaMikdash, and the whole history of the Jewish people would have been one that was not marked with the tragedies that we have left. The Ribono Shel Olam chooses to give Moshe his reward in Olam Haba, that one can imagine the enormity of that reward. If the reward was in Olam Hazeh, it would have included the banishment of all Jewish tragedy. That's the reward to one man for a part of his deeds. Imagine the enormity of the reward in Olam Haba for those deeds. We have no concept as to what the reward is. And I've often felt, we don't know what Gehenna is. We talk about Gehenim up there, hell, whatever that means. We don't know the form of suffering and the nature of suffering. But perhaps the worst suffering of all is when we see how great the reward is, how totally out of proportion it is in terms of anything we imagined, how for little deeds here there is such magnificence of response, that every little investment here achieves such results there. You know, sometimes you hear of people who've just had a lucky investment. There was a story in the paper the other day
of an old lady who went to a shareholders meeting of the Rupert organization, Rembrandt, because she's a shareholder, and I think they said she's worth 1.5 million rand, and had she not sold half of her investment, it would have been 3 million rand. And she responded, there was a young man came, I don't know how many years ago, knocked on her door and was selling shares in a new enterprise, and his name was Anton Rupert. And everybody told her not to be silly and not to get put money into that, so she put a few pounds, I don't know what it was, into that in those days. And now she's a very wealthy lady. Man looks at that one and says, such a little investment, such a lot of results. If we would know that in advance, if one would know for sure that by putting a few rand into an investment today, in 20 years or 30 years or 40 years or whatever it is, this would grow to millions. How much we would toil to be able to put in whatever we can if we knew that for sure. And how we would kick ourselves if we knew it and we didn't do it. That's Gehenna. When one comes up there and one sees how little investments turn into magnificent results, and we're going to kick ourselves because we knew that was so, we were told it was so, and we're going to see what little opportunities we missed to do a little thing here and a little thing here there that really wouldn't have cost us anything, and such enormous consequences. That's something that is a source of suffering. That's not a source of pleasure. That's the natural suffering that comes from missed opportunities. And we have to view our lives like that with every day that we live, to realize that we're investors and everything that we do is an investment. It's not a question of reward and punishment, it's just a question of using opportunities. The lady who bought those few shares in the Rembrandt organization, it wasn't a reward that they gave her a bonus and turned it into 1.5 million rand. That wasn't the reward. That was the natural result of a good investment, that's all. She did it. So it is in every opportunity that we have, our lives, every moment of our lives, waking moments and sleeping moments, 24 hours a day. The Ribbono Shel Olam gives us investment opportunities. Investment in other people. Investment in organizations. Investment in society. Investment in ourselves. Investment in our families. All the time there's an opportunity to plant seeds. That's what life is. Continuous opportunity for investment. All we have to do is recognize that opportunity. Respond to that opportunity. And sit back for the payers. Sit back for the rewards. Sit back for the growth. Sit back for the consequences and results which will be dished out in enormous measure, in a completely disproportionate measure. That is the meaning of a Torah life. That is the meaning of this concept of investing, the meaning of seeing ourselves not as tourists, missing opportunities all the time. A tourist doesn't notice investment opportunities. He's not thinking that way. He's just looking at what he can get out quick, in quick short term. Not so the resident. The resident who views his life on a longer term and views his presence on a longer term, he's looking not for what he can take out, he's looking for what he can invest. And he knows that if he invests wisely, he's going to take plenty. And that's the way we should go through our lives, all the time looking at the opportunities that are presented to us to invest in a future of greatness and to invest in a future of ruchnius.